Aloha, I'm Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Hawaii U.S. Congresswoman Jill Takuda talks with us about her no vote on the farm bill. We talk about the gender gap among Gen Z, men and women, and how it could impact the election on the Longview. We learn about a mentoring program for kupuna with STEM expertise. Can our keiki pick your brain? And a high school senior wins a top science prize with a $10,000 reward. What being curious about turtles taught him. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, Hawaii U.S. Representative Jill Takuda stopped by our studios. She was coming off a busy week in Congress and has a busy schedule working here at home. Takuda sits on the Agriculture and Armed Services Committees, which just concluded back-to-back marathon sessions. High up on the list was the Farm Bill, which Takuda voted no on in the committee. She explained her vote and why she is still optimistic, though, about its passage on the floor.
What I was most pleased about with the draft that came out, and we're talking about a 900-plus page draft, is that there were many priorities I had been pushing since coming to Congress. It was really important for me from day one in the committee to make sure that as small as Hawaii is, as unique and specialized as Hawaii crops are and agriculture is, that we had a seat at the table. And I do think that that was reflected in the draft, that being a part of the committee, having conversations, bringing Hawaii folks to meet G.T. Thompson, the chair of the Ag Committee, talking with various subcommittee chairs, we were able to have that reflected. Now, was it perfect? No. I mean, as everything usually is at this particular stage of the game. And there were definite, unfortunate partisan divides in the Farm Bill that really pushed most of us on the Democratic side to vote against the bill. We were not about to take billions of dollars of food money out of the hands of hungry children and kupuna and people and families across the country. And so, sadly, there were no votes on our side for sure, myself included. But what I am very proud of is the fact that now going into negotiations, we've got a strong position in terms of Hawaii Ag, making sure that when we talk about food money for our neighbor island communities, one thing I've been fighting very strongly for is that it's not based on Oahu calculations. It's based on rural calculations. I've been fighting for parity with Alaska that has two rural categories, which I think we should as well, given that even for the neighbor islands, you cannot say that food access and costs are the same on Moloka'i or Lana'i as it is in Kahului or even Hilo or Kona, right? And so really making sure that when we talk about ability for people to feed themselves, that it reflects the true cost and access.
It's the parity.
It's parity. And it seems so basic, and yet it has been in law for decades that we base our food calculation on Honolulu, which I think is absolutely unfair. It's what I've been pushing for. The committee actually cited it in a number of its press releases prior to the release that it was about making this fair. Again, very proud that that's right there on the table as a result of my direct advocacy.
Okay, and then we'll see when this gets on the floor for a vote?
Gets on the floor, and quite frankly, I've already been talking to Chair Stabenow on the Senate side. When they go into negotiations, it's about, again, making sure that Hawaii is right there, from food money to we increased micro grants for food security to $30 million in the House version. I think it needs to at least be there, given the huge need we have.
Anything on the appropriation side?
Appropriation side, that's still going to be worked upon. I think we are fortunate that we have a member in both the House and the Senate on the appropriations committees that's going to fight for that. But it always starts with an authorization. For example, as I just mentioned, with the micro grants for food security, ability to give individuals and small businesses money to really be able to feed themselves and their communities. It was a big deal for me to bump that authorization up to $30 million because it already has so much more demand than we have been able to put money towards. And that $30 million is going to make a difference.
Okay. And then I understand you've got a hearing next week having to do with Dr. Fauci.
Yes. The third committee that folks often don't ask me about that I serve on is the Special Select Subcommittee on the COVID pandemic. And we've had a number of contentious hearings over the past few weeks leading up to this particular point for the Republican majority. This has been the pinnacle of the committee to them. right, is how do we bring Fauci forward and blame him for everything from how COVID happened to the response. You know, for the Democratic minority, it's always been about how do we make sure we learn from what we experienced in the COVID pandemic? How do we ask tough questions? Yes, but truly focused on getting it right the next time this happens.
Right. And we're keeping a wary eye on the avian flu and that whole thing. And we just got something from the health department that the COVID numbers are up. So yeah, that has not gone away. And we just need to be mindful of all that.
We have to. And I think it's foolish on our parts if we don't learn from what we experienced over the last few years with the COVID pandemic. And we know, sadly, that whether it's avian flu or more variant strains of COVID, there will be something in the future. And the question is, how do we best prepare our public health infrastructure, especially for a state like Hawaii, where we really do need to stand on our own and make sure that we have that infrastructure for all the people in our state on every single island. We cannot truck help in. You know, we can't expect it to arrive the next day or that day. I remember with the wildfires, the police chief saying, you know, we are 72 hours away from help. So how do we make sure we're able to take care of ourselves? It's true in a wildfire. It's true in a pandemic. And so for myself, the question has always been forward-looking. How are we going to better prepare now before, you know, it hits?
And then one of our lifelines is, of course, the airlines. Mm-hmm. I understand you're heading over to Lanai to look at what they're grappling with over there with Mokulele and the other airlines that are hoping to get some federal help.
Absolutely. I mean, you talk about essential air service, as it's called, right? EAS, which everyone's talking about for Lanai, but it's absolutely essential. It's a lifeline. The ability for people to get medical care, in many cases, urgent medical care, the ability to do business, connect with family, have educational opportunities. They rely on air transportation, and it's been a real hardship, and it's been unacceptable to me, the current state. And so one of the things, as you may recall from conversations we had about my visit to Molokai, just it seems like a few weeks ago, but maybe about a month or so ago, when Alaska first called and told me, hey, we are looking at, you know, this merger with Hawaiian, I said to them, you need to come with me to Molokai Lanai. You know, let's not, you know, if I had my magic wand and could wave it, they would be able to do service directly to those islands. But that being said, you need to understand the hardship. You need to understand the unacceptable situation they live with every day, the ability to access basic health care, see loved ones, go to funerals, and be part of a solution. We need more allies at the table giving us solutions to how people can get to and from Lanai, to and from Molokai. And so, true to their word, Alaska is coming, and they're doing just a talk story with community, because it's so important that they understand that behind all of the, you know, the turmoil that's existed with, you know, neighbor island transportation, in particular for Lanai and Molokai, there are real faces, there are people. There's real stories that'll just break your heart when you listen to them. And I need them to hear that. And I need them to double down and commit on being a partner on how we're going to find some kind of solution and solutions, if you will, to making sure people have the air transportation they need.
And then you're also going to Niihau, I understand?
First visit ever to Niihau. I happen to be at an event with the superintendent. We're talking about graduation. As we know, graduation time is an important time in Hawaii. So I have been jumping from the different islands. Went to Waikea's, was able to go to Lahaina Luna's graduation, of course, Castle, my alma mater.
Ah, yes.
Very proud to see my nieces and nephews walk in the line over there. And he happened to say, hey, you know, Niihau has a graduation this year. Not every year they graduate, you know, students. As you can imagine, it's a very small population. You have to be invited and whatnot. So I'm very much looking forward to my very first visit there, being able to congratulate the two graduates that they have on island and just be able to connect with constituents, right? They are my constituents as well. So it's going to be a great, great time.
And, you know, we have just come off of the Memorial Day holiday, honoring, you know, those who have lost their lives during the wars. And I know that you have some personal connections with your family and the folks that lost their lives and fought so bravely over there in Europe.
Yeah. You know, definitely Memorial Day weekend is a time for all of us to really be able to raise up those individuals that paid the ultimate sacrifice. You know, quite frankly, we need to do this every single day and remember those who paid that ultimate sacrifice, the families left behind, those who have served and came home as well. So it's a really important time for us as a community. And then to reflect on our families and their own contributions. You know, we've got some 80th anniversary celebrations coming up, both locally, but also nationally and globally as well.
We just talked to Charles DeJoux, and he's heading over there for the big D-Day celebration next week, the commemoration.
That's going to be a huge celebration, is my understanding. It makes me think of my two uncles who have since passed. You know, they were part of the European theater as well. They served in Italy, part of the 100th Battalion as well. I think many of us here in Hawaii, we can look back at our families, the generations that came before us, and there's likely someone in our lives that stepped forward to serve. And if you think about the time in which they did, it was very tumultuous times. In many cases, they had loved ones or family members back here in the internment camps or somewhere across the country, yet they stood up bravely to say in, you know, loyalty and defense of our country, freedoms, we will go out there and serve. And so definitely a time for me to reflect on the sacrifices and service of my family members. Wounded in Actions, we've got, you know, as many have, right, Purple Hearts and other acknowledgments, but more so I think just for many of us, the family pride.
And then there's also the current climate as well, you know, with the tensions globally and just the unrest, the violence, which is just heartbreaking, you know, to read about and see on TV. It's a tough time.
You know, I can't think of in too recent memory a time when we are reaching these milestones, these, you know, anniversaries of D-Day and all of these different things where we were so close to where we were then than now. Right? I mean, oftentimes we're celebrating these 50th anniversaries or 75th anniversaries in a time of peace. But truly, when you look, as you said, globally, the war, the conflict that we're experiencing, the tensions it's creating at home as well, we could be here in 2024 or we could be back there in the 1940s or the 1950s or 60s. I mean, think of the conflicts of the past. History is definitely starting to, right, to turn around and bring us back to those very similar points. And so, again, similarly, what lessons can we learn from those, you know, moments in the past that can perhaps better help us navigate this current state, this current present and future that we are looking at?
Yeah, so hopefully as we mark these anniversaries and we just think solemnly about what happened and then look forward and pray for peace, really.
Mm-hmm. No, that has to be what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you, Congressman, for coming down and carving out time for us.
Thank you. It was good to see you.
That was Congresswoman Jill Takuda, who we sat down with earlier this morning to reflect on this busy time as we mark Memorial Day and the 40th anniversary of D-Day, the beginning of the end of World War II.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
Aloha, I'm Bert Lum. If you're interested in science, technology, and Hawaii's innovation economy, tune in to Bite Marks Cafe on Hawaii Public Radio HPR 1 today at 6:30 p.m.
Today in our segment, The Long View, we talk about the gender gap that is growing amongst Generation Z and what it could mean for the upcoming elections. Our contributing editor, Neil Milner, joins us today. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, refresh my memory, I'm having a senior moment. Generation Z, it's under 30, right?
Generation Z is roughly, if you were born from the mid-90s to the early 2010s. So, here she's talking 18 to 29, the young voter, somewhere in there. So not all Gen Zs can vote yet, but that's Gen Z and there's very specific characteristics about them. But what's interesting here and very significant is how some of the things that we've discovered about differences between genders, between male and female, to use a term that's a little bit not necessarily accepted now, but it's the easiest way to do this, what that research has suggested. How some recent stuff, which has looked more closely at political attitudes, what that suggests, and what that may all mean for the election in 2024. So Let's start very briefly with the, with this factor, and the best place to look at this is Richard Reeves' book called Of Boys and Men. And I have a site. There's a site that's a YouTube site that you can link to. That's his description of what he found. It's not about voting. It's about things. What we know, to put it very quickly, is that men are much young men and men generally have become much less successful than women in all sorts of ways. Women have moved from being a minority in college to being the majority in college. Women do better in college. They have a better outlook. They're less isolated. They're more integrated into the system. They're more optimistic, less alienated. And Reeves sees this as enough of a problem that he's really started an institution where he says, look, this is not about playing off women against men, but in fact, we have to figure out there is really a man problem along these lines here. He just received from the Melinda Gates, her own foundation, a $20 million grant. So this is serious stuff. He's a very successful economist. He's left of center guy. So it's not some conservative complaining about the role of women here. So then along comes some research recently. One piece is by his former colleague at Brookings named Elaine Kamark, who does a lot of work on voting behavior, and a colleague of hers named Jordan Muchnick, who looks at the young voter, which he calls Gen Z, and looks at the enormous gap that has formed between men and women, young men and women, on political attitudes. Women tend to be, they've recently, at least, always voted more than men. They've participated, they're less apathetic than men. They're more likely to be Democratic than men. But what we've seen, and still the young voter generally has been Democratic over the past few years, but what we see is a pretty significant split in attitudes, political attitudes. Men have become, these young men have become a greater percentage of them say that they're pro-Trump. A greater percentage of them no longer identify as liberals. This is a fairly short-term significant change. They tend to see themselves as less feminist than other generations have seen themselves. And all of these things suggest, they just suggest, as Kamark says, that, wow, what we may have here is the makings of a group of isolated, alienated people who, in fact, these men are more likely to feel discriminated against, who could be really important material for right-wing extremism. It kind of follows this alienated young men sort of thing. She leaves it at that. She says, if you look at that and you look at some of these movements toward Trump, then you really have something that could be significant in 2024.
Yeah, that could explain.
Maybe, right. That,
yeah.
But maybe yes and maybe no, because one, you can't always, you can't predict the future, and the difference between attitudes and the way they'll finally vote could be different. This is from, this is Rose Horwich's piece that's also linked in The Atlantic. She talks about this. The second thing is that if you measure, these are kind of in the weeds kind of thing, that if you measure it other ways, the differences may not even be that great, and that overall, young people are still more liberal than old people. And young people are, of course, less likely to vote than any other group. Every time we go through this, every election, we're going to change this, but there's all kinds of psychological reasons. So that's where we are right now. There's certainly that we don't know if it's going to affect or how much it will affect the 2024 election. On the surface, it sure seems like another, to use a Yiddish word, tsuris, trouble for Joe Biden, another group that's leaking from him. But we don't know for sure. What we do know for sure is that there are these important psychological and behavioral differences increasingly between men and women, young men and young, and it shows up more in Generation Z, that can really affect the way things work. This is what Reeves is so concerned with. This is why he wants policies that don't take away from women, but that build up the capacity of men to be able to do it.
Yeah, we've talked with that
about this issue before.
Right? The mental health issue,
the isolation issue. Young women are much more likely to be married than young men. young among certain communities, African American women have a harder time finding mates because of these kinds of success differences.
Mm.
And they don't want to necessarily marry someone who's going to be, I guess, a burden is the way to look at it. We know that. That's pretty much for sure. How that's going to play out in politics in 2024, we don't know that for sure. There are some signs there that would suggest it. But it clearly has become an important social problem and an important social issue that, frankly, I don't want to see get controlled by conservative demagogues, not just conservatives generally, who want to see this as a way of doing the poor men lashing against women. So far, we've avoided that. But I think there's a significant issue coming up in November 2024 about this.
So, yeah, so if the president wants to hang on to his job, he needs to look at demographic, because it's kind of squishy.
the narrative that's going on now is Biden is leaking in all kinds of his places. And he is, but we don't know how much, and we don't know how much that's going to stay. I mean, how much the exaggeration is that more African-American men, for example, are less likely to vote for him. You have to remember two things, one of which is it may be a small percentage, but on the other hand, in a close election, a small percentage can make a difference.
Yeah, because every vote counts.
Yeah, well, because it doesn't take much. You know, it's winner take all in a state. And if the state of Wisconsin loses enough black voters for Democrats, then it could go the other way.
And it's interesting, too, just to see what's been going on with the college campuses and the protests
and
how that might play out.
Most of the college campuses, it's only a minority of campuses that have done this.
Yeah,
it tends to be elite campuses. It tends not to be campuses that have Pell Grants. And if you look, this is an interesting, if you look at how important the war between Israel and Hamas is in the priorities that young voters set, it's very low. It's not really high on their agenda. So you can't let the vision of the protest, you can't generalize from that.
Right, yeah. But still, our young people, and interesting to see those whippersnappers.
Right. Why can't they be like we were, perfect in every way, as the song went in Bye Bye Birdie, which also it dates me.
Okay, yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much, Neil.
Sure.
That was our contributing editor, Neil Milner, joining us for The Long View. We'll have links to the articles and the video he mentioned on the conversation page of our website later today. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We have a story about a local high school student who recently won a $10,000 prize coming up later in the show. So today, we're testing your knowledge of most teenagers' favorite food, pizza. Walk into most pizza places on the continent and you'll likely see something called a Hawaiian pizza on the menu. If you've never seen one, you might expect to find a kalua pork or poke or maybe even Spam on it. But what the rest of North America calls a Hawaiian pizza is actually a normal cheese pizza with slices of canned pineapple and ham laid on top. So it shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone who really knows Hawaii that the so-called Hawaiian pizza was not actually invented here, nor did the inventor have any ties to our islands. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know where the Hawaiian pizza was invented. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
How do we give back to the community in our golden years? A new mentorship program aims to bring kupuna to the classrooms to share their knowledge about STEM fields. That's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Al Ogata, the president and CEO of Cyber Hawaii, started the new pilot program with Cullen Hayashida, an affiliate faculty member with the University of Hawaii Sociology Department. The program will be gearing up over the summer with plans to launch in the fall. Hayashida and Ogata recently sat down with The Conversation's Maddie Bender to talk about bridging the intergenerational gap. Hayashida starts us off.
We are all very much aware of the fact that people are living longer, but looking at this entire situation from a societal standpoint, we're seeing this explosion of older adults, primarily the boomer population, but at the same time, a shrinkage of the working population. So there's some challenges in terms of maintaining a sustainable society. In the meantime, we have older adults that are retiring and oftentimes not certain exactly what to do with the rest of their lives. And they've got another 20 to 30 bonus years ahead of them. They've got skills, they got talent, they got experience, they got connections, and many of them are financially independent, and they've got an enormous amount of time on their hands. And what we're trying to do is find a way of marshaling all that resource for the greater good.
And Al, maybe here's a good point for you to jump in and talk about how this partnership between Cyber Hawaii and UH developed.
A short while back, I got a call from Grant Toyooka, who is a resource teacher with Elelehua Wailua Mililani School District. And they had a class project related to cybersecurity, and he was asking if I would help to mentor. So as we were talking, it became clear that there are many opportunities that schools have for people with experience in certain fields who wanted to help out the keiki, who wanted to contribute some time to really improve their learning. The bigger benefit than just, say, tutoring a single class would be to figure out a way to help multiple classes, to help more than just one teacher, to help more than just one school, to help more than just one school district. And really, Cyber Hawaii focuses on trying to broaden the understanding of cyber threats, be aware of information technology, and to help our workforce develop into being more resilient consumers online. So the thing that we talked about was if we could set up that kind of platform and utilize the school's needs as a way to identify a cause or a project, and the folks that Cullen works with related to people who have skills who want to give back and have the time to do it, we might be able to solve a problem that's been lingering for us here in Hawaii for quite a while.
Are there particular STEM-related industries, when you look at the aging workforce that might be interested in this program, what sorts of jobs are they retiring from, especially here in Hawaii?
When we look at this first topic area, STEM, that we're talking about, Hawaii has quite a few engineering companies, architectural firms, a lot of businesses that deal with the federal government, whether it's the military or whether it's other agencies, who hire scientists, engineers, mathematicians. And really, those are the folks coming out of long-term careers doing solid work who love Hawaii and want to stay here. I think the last number I saw was that about 20% of the population in Hawaii is over 65. We see that the pool is being pretty big.
We don't think of this merely as one of giving. It's mutually beneficial. If we retire and for the first 2 years, perhaps, you know, we're decompressing, we're enjoying the fact that we don't have all the pressures of work from 9 to 5, and perhaps we take long cruises and vacations and golf and, you know, that sort of thing. But after a while, I think people will find that they become lonely, they become depressed, bored, and, you know, they may find that they can remain very busy, but the busyness is not necessarily fulfilling. And so I think by giving, they will grow and they will find that they will find passion and reason and meaning an opportunity to give back to the community. It's a way to matter, to be useful, and basically to help the next generation.
It's actually meant to be bidirectional in nature. We read reports about Gen Z folks who are saying they experience loneliness themselves. The fact is that many Gen Zers spend lots of time online, and they may not have a lot of connection, say, with other people or with potentially older kupuna. The first place we're starting is really how kupuna can help the younger folks in class, but really the reverse works as well. So as we get into the process, having kids be able to help kupuna in technology, in online use, social media, is also part of it, because it's not just one generation that has something to teach another. Every generation has something to teach the other generation.
How do you see this program working in practice? Is it the kind of thing where you'll match people up, and how often will mentorship sessions take place?
So because we're starting with formal schools, Department of Education, the opportunities likely would be during the normal school year, with summer being used for planning purposes. The concept to start with is for teachers or resource teachers to identify their need, to document what they're looking for, the kind of mentor they'd like to have, what the mentor is expected to do, and then have that be placed someplace that's secure, that folks who have a desire to help out and to participate in these programs can basically go to, list their information, identify their background capabilities, and then have a way to match them up. After they get the initial match, then it goes back to basically a conversation. The teacher would kind of explain what they're looking for, and then the mentor, potential mentor, would explain what they're able to do, and then they would engage in some kind of arrangement to help the class.
Now, we don't want people simply to volunteer by licking stamps, for example. We're looking for good skills, right? And as a way of giving back to the community. When you graduate from high school, you've got a whole variety of assistance that is provided to you. You've got academic counselors, you've got an SAT test, you've got technical school, community college, university, sometimes the military, or, you know, internships, right? All that preparation for your career, 20 to 30 years of work. You hit 65, it's like falling off a cliff. There's nobody there to help you. What Al is doing is, in a sense, the first attempt in Hawaii to try to build that infrastructure to guide people through this process. And so, you know, we're quite excited about this.
And that's so important, because you think, for instance, I mean, as a young person having to help older relatives with tech support,
yep,
you might be under the impression that, oh, they don't know how to use certain technologies, certain computers. But really, by doing a mentorship type program, the younger generation can learn that their kupuna actually do have expertise and mastery, yep, in a, yeah, lot of STEM-related fields.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is from a broader societal perspective. The old are able to get all of this resources from those that are working today. And there's a potential for additional resentments that build up over time, right? And they're people that have been talking about this, not necessarily in Hawaii per se, but elsewhere, of this intergenerational conflict, resentment, a burden that happens. So some of this kind of activity that we're talking about is to try to moderate that, to reverse that. And part of the broader perspective that I tend to take, we look at the whole area of gerontology, for example, the study of older adults. And most of the work that has been done to date has focused around old people as sick, need of long-term care, being frail. And what we're trying to do in a sense is to look at this group of population, the older adults that are retiring in great numbers that have, you know, many additional years to live and to contribute. So we're looking at age from an asset perspective. So this is, in a sense, a broader movement. And part of that broader movement may have to be just getting people to think in terms of this kind of intergenerational connection. And part of it has to be fun. So one idea that people have said is, hey, maybe we need to look at even making people aware of intergenerational games that they can get involved with, so that once they get into the mood of understanding that age is an asset, intergenerational relationship is fun, then maybe we can then move on to the next stage of saying, hey, perhaps we can start giving back. So this is all part of a broader attempt as well.
What are the kinds of connections that you hope are formed because of this program? And what kinds of experiences do you want both the kupuna and the mentees, the students, to get out of this?
So I think what we're hoping for in a year is to have an environment up and running that teachers, resource teachers, schools feel comfortable sharing their needs and being able to put it out there for others to see. And that we have that same area be comfortable for kupuna to be able to say, I'd like to help. I'd like to be there. I think it's going to really, not a year out, but a little longer than that, have an impact, I think, on how kids, keiki, go into society, how they decide what they want to do, what they want to be, and the path that they take to get there.
Well, as you can tell, both of us are retired, right? I have more hair than he does, but mine's white. But it's an opportunity for us, for example, to have a passion. I mean, because, you know, I'm 79 right now, and life expectancy, what, 85 in Hawaii for men? You know, there's questions having to do with what is it that I'm going to do with the rest of my life, right? And an opportunity to actually give back and get passionate about living is what this is all about. And an opportunity to leave a legacy, to make a difference, to matter, to be useful, will help you health-wise. And that's part of the reason why we get so excited about being able to do this.
Yeah. No, I think that's really wonderful and a wonderful place to land on. And if listeners hear this and are interested in learning more about the pilot program, there's going to be an information session Thursday, May 30th from 9 to 11. And where can they go to learn more about that?
They can go to our website, cyberhawaii.org, and look at the events page, and it'll be listed there as the Kupuna Mentor Program.
Well, thank you both so much for coming into the studio today. I really enjoyed our chat.
Thank you.
That was Al Ogata and Cullen Hayashida. They were talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Ogata says they hope to seek funding down the line to expand the program to other school districts and subject areas beyond STEM. Kupuna interested in participating as mentors can learn more at tomorrow's information session, which will be held at the University of Hawaii at Manoa Innovation Center from 9 to 11 a.m. We'll have a link to registration on our website later today.
On the next Fresh Air, Yo-Yo Ma, the most revered cellist in America. He'll talk about his life as a musician, starting with learning a Bach cello suite when he was 4. And he'll play some pieces on his cello, Petunia, including what he plays at memorials and commemorations, and what he loves to play for himself. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
You are invited to HPR Generation Listens Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and connect with fellow HPR fans. Gather your team of up to 6 public radio nerds and sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
With over 80,000 individual birds on Hawaii Island, the amakihi are among our most common honeycreeper species. Still, a sighting of this yellow singer is a treat for any bird watcher. And we have got their song for you. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart with your Manu Minute.
In Ohia Forest, all over the Big Island, you can hear the song of the Hawaii amakihi. It's one of over 50 species known as Hawaiian honeycreepers that all trace their ancestry to a single finch that came from Asia to Hawaii over 5 million years ago. Amakihi forage for nectar and insects, and sometimes even fly into neighborhoods in Puna and Kona. In traditional Hawaiian culture, their yellow and green feathers were used in beautiful ahuula, or feather cloaks, worn by the ali'i. In stories, their calls were often seen as the scolding voice of reason. Because mosquitoes are not native to Hawaii, many honey creepers don't have a natural resistance to mosquito-transmitted diseases like avian malaria. But lucky for us, the amakihi is one of the few that does.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Evergreen by Debra. At evergreenbydebra.com, learn more about porcelain tile by Royal Mosa, made using recycled water and hydroelectric power to create floor and wall tiles inspired by trends in design and architecture.
And now it's time to deliver the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier we asked you to name the city where the Hawaiian pizza was invented. Here's a hint. It's not anywhere in Hawaii. The tale begins in Greece. The year was 1954, and soon-to-be immigrant Sam Panopoulos had just boarded a ship bound for Canada. That ship made a brief stop in Naples, Italy, which is credited as the historical birthplace of pizza. After resettling in Canada, Panopoulos opened a successful diner called the Satellite Restaurant in 1960. And at the time, the combination of Hawaii statehood and the tales told by World War II servicemen had elevated Hawaii into the nation's pop culture and the world's consciousness as a whole. In 1962, Panopoulos added pizza with pineapple on it to his menu. Because the fruit was widely associated with our islands and a staple of our economy at the time, Panopoulos dubbed his new sweet and savory creation Hawaiian Pizza when he debuted it in Chatham, Ontario. Chatham is located across the border from Michigan, not far from Detroit, and is the answer to today's backyard quiz. And our winner today, Raul from Pupukea, got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have one you'd like to share, write to Talk Back at hawaiipublicradio.org. Iolani High School senior Maddox Springer graduates this Saturday with $10,000 in his pocket. It was prize money for his science project that explained why green sea turtles in Kaneohe Bay were developing fatal tumors. Springer won first place in the animal science category after competing alongside nearly 2,000 global entries. His research into the green turtles' diet of invasive algae as the primary cancer cause was awarded the Peggy Scripps Award for Science and Communication. The Conversation's Lillian Song sat down with him in our studios.
The green sea turtles in Hawaii, they're actually special because the tumors can occur internally and externally on them. And it also occurs in the glottis, which is this flap in the back of the turtle's throat. And Hawaii is the only place where the green sea turtles have these tumors on their glottis. And what caused this disease, it's called fibropapillomatosis. I like to call it FP because it's a very, very long word. When the green sea turtles have the tumors on the glottis, they drown because they can't close their throat when they go underwater. So they just drown. And I mean, that paired with the idea that they have it internally too, which can potentially cause organ failure, as well as they have it externally, which it's an issue because it occurs on their eyes, and that's really, really important for their feeding and for evading predators. And I've seen it on the flippers where it's just completely immobilized because these tumors just envelop them. So I wanted to see if I could try to like reach out to a professor and find this answer. I reached out to 50 professors at UH, and I got one response from Dr. Celia Smith. And she really helped me to look further into this disease. And she really helped try to focus my study in areas that she thought would be beneficial for me. Come up with a plan of attack, if you will. That really was the next step for me in trying to figure out what the cause of this disease was.
But everything was spurred by your curiosity.
Yeah, all this originated from me diving in Kaneohe Bay and wondering why these tumors exist.
Sounds like you were actually on it too, young man. I mean, yes. The fact that you sent out 50 inquiries,
yeah.
Want to find some answers, and Professor Smith actually responded, and then it sounds like she's been very instrumental in your growth,
yeah.
In guiding you along this path.
Definitely.
We're going to fast forward, because I just heard about your competition win that you just returned from a few weeks ago on May 17th, Regeneron and Society for Science. They announced the top winners in the Regeneron International Science and Engineering Fair, the world's largest international high school science competition. And in total, more than $9 million were awarded to the finalists. Now, this competition featured nearly 2,000 young scientists representing 49 U.S. states and nearly 70 countries, so international. Maddox, you were there, and you won the Peggy Scripps Award for Science Communication that came with a $10,000 award.
I did.
So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
What an experience. You were there to share your project on this global stage, and how did you find out that you'd won?
The how the award ceremony works is they wait to call the first place until the very end. For every category, there's 22 categories. And they call the fourth, third, second. So when I didn't hear my name get called in the beginning, I thought it was really over for me. I thought I didn't win anything. I thought I wasn't going to be able to get my project out into the public. But the first animal science, first place, when they called the name, it was my name. And I was shocked. I mean, I was elated. I had just got the opportunity to place first, I mean, across the world. I mean, that has been my dream over the last 2.5 years of exploring this project, to be able to place first, not only to win the prize money, if you will, but so I could have a platform to share this project and share my study with media, like here, and with scholars across the world. So that really, that was unimaginable. And then after that, and we went through a couple more ceremonious activities, and they started calling the top 7 awards, which are the grand awards, if you will. And they called my name. I couldn't really believe it, because I personally didn't think my project was of the top 7 caliber in the world. But they did. They called my name. And I didn't really know what to think. I was shocked. But it all happened really, really fast. And there I was. I was on stage. I was in front of thousands of people. And I had won this award. And I was really excited, because I knew that at that moment that the turtles, that they're going to get the awareness that they really need in order to improve as a species, in order for their mortality rate to decrease, in order for them to be able to perpetuate into the future. I knew that the turtles were going to have a better chance because of me, because of this award. So I'm really, really grateful to ICEF, Regeneron, and the Society for Science for giving me that opportunity to be able to share my project with the world. And not only that, but to help increase the turtles' chances of survival and perpetuate their populations into the future.
Mm. Now, Maddox, doing your project, for our listeners, like, you know, for layman ears, how are you breaking down and understanding what you're learning?
Yeah, so fibropapillomatosis, or FP, is currently one of the number one causes of mortality in all 7 marine turtle species, which are all endangered or critically endangered at this point in time, and caused by the latent Kelowna alpha herpes virus number 5. So all that means is that this virus that causes these tumors to occur on the green sea turtles needs to be triggered by an external factor. And a previous study that I looked at found that arginine was at high concentrations inside the tumor biopsies. And wastewater has also been shown to increase the levels of arginine in invasive algae. And because algae is the main component of the green sea turtle's diet, I theorized for my study that I was trying to prove that there's a connection between high levels of wastewater that are outputted from cesspools and sewage treatment mains, high levels of invasive algae, and high levels of arginine being stored in the invasive algae. And I wanted to connect that to the fibropapillomatosis rates in the green sea turtles in those similar areas. So essentially, I was finding an association between wastewater and fibropapillomatosis through the pathway of wastewater to algae, algae to invasive algae to higher levels of arginine stored in their tissue, and higher levels of arginine consumed by the green sea turtles that eat these higher levels of invasive algae.
So primary way that they're getting the arginine is through ingestion. So it's not swimming in the water.
No, it's because invasive algae can uptake nitrogen at tenfold the times that a native algae can.
Okay. All this data collection, it takes time to process, to analyze.
Yeah, I worked with multiple people over the years on this project. It wasn't just me. Worked with a fellow person in my class, Trenton Lau, and Ellie Sugimoto, who's a junior, both at Iolani right now. And they helped me along the way. Trenton really helped me in the beginning to collect the data and was my team member. And Ellie came in along the way to help me out with that too. It was definitely a team effort. My research professor at Iolani, Dr. Yvonne Chan, as well as Mrs. Kobayashi, they really helped too. So it was really a collaborative effort. I mean, I could not have really done this by myself. Mm-hmm. But it was still a lot of time of me putting in the hours out in Kaneohe Bay and diving or taking algal samples or setting up underwater cameras and such.
Wow. Okay, so learning a lot about your project. And for you, as you head off into your freshman year at the University of Oregon this fall, and reflecting on your high school career at Iolani and how much you've put into this research project, what wisdoms can you share to someone listening today?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, one of the biggest things that I've learned is that you have to be okay with failure throughout these types of projects. And I feel like this is with all levels, from being a freshman working on this project, I mean, all the way up to getting a PhD. Being okay and accepting failure and using it to move on is really something that's important, that I found essential in my research. Because there's so many points along the way where you do something, where you try something, and it just fails. And it fails, and it fails, and it fails. And sometimes you just want to give up because you look at your data and you're like, I've shown absolutely nothing. There's no connection here. Why am I doing this? You start questioning why you're putting hundreds of hours into a project if it's just going to turn up with nothing. And I mean, if I stopped, if I got to one of those points now, it's just like, I give up, I'm done. I mean, I wouldn't have gotten to the place I am now. So it's really important that when you have something, when you have a passion, and I think this applies to really everyone, that you really can't just accept failure and give up. You have to take it. You have to take it all. And you have to use it to motivate yourself and to look for other ideas, because there's always something else out there. There's always another test you could do. There's always another place where you could look for your data. Just because one test says something doesn't mean that that is really what it is. And I feel like being able to distinguish a failure from an instrument or a failure because of a mistake you did maybe between overall failure of your project is really important, because that's what really allows you to continue your project and be able to eventually come up with a conclusion like I did with my project.
What inspiring words about failure. That was 18-year-old Maddox Springer talking to HPR's Lillian Song. He did share one failure with us. After collecting and analyzing what he thought were turtle droppings from an Oahu beach, he found out it was actually human poop. Springer's award-winning science project found a link between the high levels of wastewater in Kaneohe Bay and the fatal tumors that green sea turtles were developing. He wants to spread awareness of this issue and plans to sit down and share his findings with Governor Josh Green. Look for links to his research on our website after the show.
So happy together.
We have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to take a closer look at Hawaiian Electric's plan to pull the plug on power to prevent the spread of wildfires. Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. The conversation is available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.